This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Robert Engelman, Vice President for Programs at World Watch Institute, formerly Vice President for Research at Population Action International, and founding secretary of the Society of Environmental Journalists. Robert has served on the faculty of Yale University. His writing has appeared in Nature, The Washington Post, and The Wall Street Journal. Robert Engelman is here today to tell us about his book, More, Population, Nature, and What Women Want, published in 2008 by Island Press. Welcome.
Thank you, Diane.
What led you to write your book, More?
For a long time, particularly as an environmental reporter and as an overall tree hug and earth lover, I guess you could say, I've been fascinated by the connections between environmental sustainability and human behavior. Obviously, the reason the environment is in the difficulty it is has to do with humanity. We're not going anywhere, but that still leaves open the question of, can we behave differently? Are there aspects of humanity that would contribute to sustainability? And population always struck me as something that was clearly a big part of the puzzle, not the whole puzzle, but a big part of it, and didn't get much attention. And I delved into it as a reporter initially, and then eventually joined an organization that worked on the issue. You mentioned it in your introduction, Population Action International. And I just found it positive and fascinating, positive in the sense that people tend to be overwhelmed by it and feel there's nothing you can do because, as people often say, folks want to have children and you can't tell them not to. But they're really missing the point, which is that women in particular want to have some kind of autonomy or self-management or control over their own childbearing. And that's exactly what is missing and has been missing throughout much of history. And it's, I argue, one of the biggest reasons that our population has grown as it has and become a rather substantial environmental force on the planet.
How is our current population level affecting our efforts to prevent climate change and protect the environment? What effect does more people have on the world?
Well, I mean, from a simple perspective, it's pretty obvious that if our population had stabilized worldwide centuries ago at the levels that it was then, a billion or 2 billion or even lower, it was 300 million for most of the first 1,000 years after the Roman Empire in the period AD. And it stayed fairly stable around 300 million for 1,000 years. If we had never taken off in our growth as we did in the second millennium, we wouldn't be wrestling with these issues. We might be quite a lot different in many other ways, too. There probably wouldn't have been an industrial revolution and a lot about society to be different. So on one level, the fact that climate change, for example, is so difficult to deal with and so hard to find alternative energies that can be scaled up fast enough to solve this problem, it's just a reflection of how many of us there are behaving the way that we do. And of course, there are a lot of varieties and diversity in consumption levels that have to be taken into account as well. So in that sense, we're suffering the effects of a very large human population that in some ways has overwhelmed a number of planetary systems. That doesn't help us figure out where we go from here, obviously. We're not going back to some lower population anytime soon. So the real issue is, do we want to look at what we can do relative to population to assist us in all the other things that we have to do relating to consumption, new technologies, things of that kind, in order to solve problems like climate change, energy prices, food prices? And what I find in looking at this is absolutely that addressing population is one of the most positive, no-lose options that's available to us. And I say no-lose because there's no real price to be paid that I can find at all in giving women better control over their own bodies and their own reproduction, letting them choose to have fewer children, which they will, and in slowing population growth. Unless you believe that we have to have perpetual population growth to grow the world's economies, and I don't, then there's no loss in a lower trajectory of human population growth whatsoever. And especially over the long term, it provides a platform for environmental sustainability if we do everything else that we need to do.
Looking to the past, what is likely to account for the increases in human population in the early days of Homo sapiens?
Well, the main thing that made for this unprecedented leap in population was that we got very good, and when I say we, I mostly mean women, and I discuss this in the book, that it was largely women's skills and women's care that accomplished this incredible feat of bringing more than two children to adulthood so that they too could become parents. You have to do that in every generation to keep the population growing. And we did that pretty well from the time that Homo sapiens emerged from an apparent genetic bottleneck back in about 70,000 years ago when there were just a couple tens of thousands of people. And somehow after that bottleneck, and there's a lot of mysteries around this, we became extremely good at raising two or more, often three, sometimes five or ten, children to adulthood so that they too could become parents. And it was this that expanded the human population so that we left Africa, went to Europe and eventually to Asia and eventually to the Americas and the islands of the Pacific and basically peopled the world. Along the way, we probably outbred the Neanderthals and perhaps some other hominid species and became the only human species and pretty much took over the planet. At various times, population was stable, probably because there were problems keeping a number of children alive. That is, children often did die in infancy or even at birth. But I also argue that there's good evidence that at various times in human history, population growth was slow or even didn't occur much at all, in part because women had found ways to regulate their own fertility through various kinds of contraceptives, in some cases through abortion, in some cases through infanticide, and that when they had permission to do this, that is, the broader society didn't put obstacles in their way of doing this, we might have gone through long periods, centuries, even thousands of years, of fairly stable populations at low levels. We might have done this much of the time we were hunter-gatherers, for example. But at various times as population did grow, institutions arose, often run by male elites, and religions were founded, and various institutions arose that had interests in large numbers of people to be soldiers, to be farmers and produce surplus food, to build pyramids, whatever. And at these times, often it became harder for women to regulate their own fertility, and that was discouraged. And we have good evidence of that in 1000 BC, 500 BC, and on up to the present time, quite frankly, with the influence of certain religions. So part of what I argue in the book is that both historically and based on contemporary research in modern societies, it's pretty obvious that where obstacles are placed in front of women in terms of deciding when to bear a child, population tends to be less environmentally sustainable, you know, where it tends to grow rapidly. Whereas when there are fewer obstacles, or best of all, no obstacles at all, and women can make these decisions for themselves, they tend to have fairly small families and fairly healthy families. Infant mortality goes down, child mortality goes down, and population growth and family size both go down. And that's a good lesson for the future, that if we make sure that there's a range of healthy and effective approaches to contraception that women can take advantage of, ideally with their partners, but if their partners don't agree, it's women who do bear children and they should have the final say, then it's pretty clear to me, and I try to build this case, that we will average around two children per woman and will stabilize world population, and eventually population will probably decline slightly. And you can see evidence of where that's happened in European countries and other places in the world where, in fact, fertility is less than two, and some governments have started to worry that there aren't enough babies. Well, from an environmental perspective, it's probably a pretty good overall outcome. I don't think the economic challenges are quite as dangerous as some people make them out to be. And from an environmental perspective, it's pretty much what the doctor ordered, as I suggest in my book.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Robert Engelman, Vice President for Programs at World Watch Institute, and author of the book, More, Population, Nature, and What Women Want. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What types of contraception were used in the past? What was available to people?
Well, some of it is fairly well documented. Actually, there are mentions of contraception almost as old as there is writing. A kind of crocodile dung that was apparently used as a pessary, that is, it was placed internally into the vagina and to block the cervix, is documented in Egyptian hieroglyphics going back about 5,000 years. We don't know a lot, but there are various herbs that are mentioned in Greek literature and various literatures around the Mediterranean basin, a little bit in Chinese and Asian literatures, but most of our information comes from classical Greek literature. And a lot of this wisdom was passed down from woman to woman. I suggest that midwives were major sources of wisdom about contraception. Then there were also just basic things like withdrawal, and there were various approaches to abortion. But the view is that in many societies, women had a number of options. If enough women were doing this in the past. It may well have significantly reduced population growth. And in fact, in medieval Europe, there were long periods of time when family size was fairly small and growth was either non-existent or fairly low, and that this only really ended around the time of the witch trials in Europe, which may in fact have been aimed partly at midwives to discourage them from teaching their patients and clients about contraception and abortion.
Well, you've been alluding to this, but looking at the 21st century, what most consistently correlates with reduced fertility and falling population?
Two things in particular: strong women and good access to contraception. And by strong women, what I mean is women who have autonomy in their own lives, are able to manage their own lives without interference from husbands, partners, mothers-in-law, tribal chiefs, religion, institutions, people and groups that often are trying to tell women you shouldn't be doing this or you shouldn't be doing that. When women have a reasonable amount of status, or when they can actually use contraception without anybody else knowing about it, and there are contraceptives that are pretty hard to detect in terms of their use, that's one of the key ingredients. But as much or even more than that is simply having access to a range of good family planning and health services that serve the needs of individual women users and allow them to pick an option that will enable them to prevent conception the way they need to for their own circumstances. Obviously, a condom on a male part expands the effectiveness and the safety of all these methods. So there's a variety of different methods that people need to choose from, and they have to have those choices. There are a lot of family planning systems in the world where women might be able to have their tubes tied, or a male might be able to get a vasectomy, but there aren't a lot of other choices. That's not sufficient because not everybody wants to end their childbearing altogether. Quite a few people want to delay childbearing. So you need to have a range of 3, 4, 5 methods that will be optimal for women and for couples to choose from. And it needs to be close at hand. If a woman's got to walk a day and a half or 2 days to find someone that can provide her with her monthly cycle of pills, it's much less likely to happen. And this is one of the big reasons that rural women in Africa have very large families. It's not that they're really anxious to have 7, 8, 9, 10 children. I argue, at least based on my own interviews with them and some studies that have been done, that they just don't really have access to a means to time the actual childbearing.
How many women of childbearing age are using contraception worldwide?
Well, we know of the world's 6.7 billion that roughly half of these people are men and women who are of childbearing age, might be slightly higher than that. And about 50 to 60%, it's actually pretty close to 60% now worldwide, of partners in men and women are in fact having sex that is contraceptively protected. One of the other partners is using contraception, which is a phenomenal figure. It basically means that most people are using contraception, except, of course, when they want to become pregnant. It may not always be working perfectly, but they're using it. Some of this is probably traditional contraception. It may not be as effective as modern contraception. But it's a high number given that up until the 70s or 80s, most people were not. And it's also a high number when you figure that a good 10 or 15 or 20% of women in particular may not be sexually active. They may not be with a partner. They may be pregnant. A high number of women are pregnant. About 100 million women in the world are pregnant at any one time. Obviously, they're not using contraception. Or probably a similar amount of women are trying to become pregnant. But the fact that something like 61, 62% of women around the world are either using contraception or their partner is remarkable. And it's the main reason that family size is down from an average of 5 or 6 children per woman, as it was in the, say, 50s and 60s, to less than 3 today. The average woman now has, well, on average, 2.6 children. Obviously, no woman has 0.6 children, but the average is between 2 and 3 for women around the world. That's astounding. That's a real social revolution, and it's one of the reasons that things are better than they might have been as far as climate change is concerned. If you imagine, for example, that human fertility did not decrease at all from the 50s to today, and the average woman around the world was having 5 children, we would have something more like 8.5 or maybe even closer to 9 billion people right now. And all the problems we have of food scarcity, changing climate, high energy prices, water scarcity would be 20, 30, who knows, 40% possibly worse than they are today, just based on averages. But the revolution isn't finished. It's a kind of a social revolution, but in fact, until the average childbearing among women is closer to 2.1, 2.2, we won't finally level off world population or have the gradual decline in world population based on birth rate declines that I argue in the book would probably be helpful to us as far as environmental sustainability is concerned.
What have been some of the challenges in making family planning services available to all who want them?
The main challenge is apathy and outright hostility by governments and by various institutions that are not in favor of contraception. The Catholic Church, for example, has a position against modern contraception, and it's actually put up quite a few roadblocks, not only in Catholic countries, but in countries like our own, where there's a diversity of religions. And they're not the only religion. There's some fundamentalist Christian religions that have similar views about these matters. Islam has occasionally been an obstacle, although there's no consistent or coherent view about family planning and contraception that I've been able to find within Islam, and Islamic scholars have told me there's a diversity of views among Islamic scholars about this, but certainly some Islamic leaders have believed that it's not a good idea and that it isn't an Islamic thing for people to do, to use contraception. So many of them have used their influence with governments to say this is not something that we really want to be providing or talking about. Some governments, and it's worth recalling, because I do talk a lot about the differences between men and women and the way they see these issues, some governments tend to be run primarily by men, and there's sort of a sense that, well, we need more people to make our country powerful or our state or municipality powerful, and there's a saying that goes back to the Persians that in numbers is strength, and a ruler with no subjects is not much of a ruler. So there's this kind of bias by governments and to some extent by businesses that, you know, the more the merrier. More customers, more citizens, more soldiers, it's all good. So if we introduce family planning and let women decide about these things, it may well be that we won't have very many people anymore. So there's sort of this fear of it that's visceral. It's deep-seated in people, and I think particularly in men. And when you combine all these things, there's just there's a lack of enthusiasm, let's put it that way, for making sure that basic health services are available that allow women to make choices about when they'll bear children. And sadly, that also means that there's less health care available for bearing healthy children and for, in fact, surviving pregnancy. And it's one of the reasons that something like 500,000 women die as a result of pregnancy and childbirth every year. It's not just an issue of contracepting. It's an issue of having a healthy child and raising a healthy child when you want to. These things are all tied together in a concept called reproductive health that should be just a basic aspect of primary health care, but ends up being considered controversial because of its connections not only to contraception but also abortion. And the end result is that a lot of governments just say, well, it's safer to just kind of leave it alone and hope that women can find someone to help them on their own. So it's been a mixed bag worldwide in terms of actually making this available to all women who want it. It's not really terribly expensive, but there just hasn't been much attention placed on it, or as much as needs to be in the last 10 to 15 years because of the HIV pandemic and because, frankly, people are afraid of talking about population. And for good or for ill, one of the reasons people got interested in family planning in the past was that it was seen as a way to slow the growth of the world's population. And now there's less talk about that. One reason I wrote the book. Less discussion of that and more fear that, well, maybe if we get involved with that, it'll be a little bit like China and we'll be forcing women to have one child, which is not really that great a danger if we guard against it, but that inhibits people further from talking about it as well.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Robert Engelman, Vice President for Programs at World Watch Institute, and author of the book, More, Population, Nature, and What Women Want. Which countries are currently close to replacement level?
Well, there are a number of countries that are below replacement level. That is, women on average in these countries have fewer than 2.1 or so children, again, at the average of all women's childbearing. Most of Europe, including Catholic countries like Italy, Spain, or predominantly Catholic countries, I guess I should say, Ireland has about an average of 2 children per woman. A lot of countries that we associate in the past with having very large families now have family sizes of 2 or fewer. So almost all of Europe, Eastern Europe, is quite low. It's down to closer to 1 than to 2, so 1.3, 1.4, to the extent that many governments are really very concerned about what will happen to their country's population in the long term. But surprisingly, there are a number of developing countries as well that have replacement fertility or lower. One of the most interesting ones, and one of the newest members of the replacement club, is Iran, a country that a lot of people in America are very concerned about. Well, in one sense, at least, Iran is heading towards sustainability in a way that many other countries are not. And it's an Islamic country as well. Fertility rates in Iran are around 2 children per woman, which is replacement. And it reflects a fairly active governmental effort for the past 5, 6, 7 years to make sure that all people who get married, for example, have access to marital counseling on the use of contraception. And the country has just bent over backwards to make sure that there's good availability of a variety of contraceptive methods throughout the country for anyone who's interested in them. Well, I think they do focus especially on married couples, but it's been quite successful. Thailand has a fertility rate that's pretty close to 2. Not many people are aware of it, but Mexico, the neighbor to the south of us, which many people also associate with large families, now is coming very close to replacement fertility. It's at about 2.2. So that even people in Mexico are beginning to worry, some government people anyway, that Mexico may need to have more babies. It's an interesting relation to migration. There's still high levels of migration from Mexico into the United States, but they're not babies. There are people who were born 20, 30 years ago when family sizes were much larger, and so they're members of the generation that it was sort of a baby boom. I mean, it's been hard for them to find work because their generational size is huge, and it's one reason that many Mexicans migrate to this country to look for work. Well, one of the hopeful things about Mexico, a developing country, having replacement fertility is that over time, and not because of any particular walls, hopefully, that the U.S. builds or any restrictions on immigration, it seems likely that the immigration pressure from Mexico will be reduced because people are happy to stay in Mexico and their jobs for them in decent wages. That's one of the benefits, too, of replacement fertility in developing countries. People don't tend to leave these countries because they really hate them or they have a real yen for travel. They leave out of desperation because there aren't good jobs and there aren't high wages. Well, as replacement fertility works its way to the laboring ages, the labor force, there are fewer laborers for the economy and their wages tend to go up and there tend to be more opportunities for them. So Latin America generally is getting pretty close to replacement fertility. Even South Africa, there are a few places in Africa where we're getting pretty close to that number. But nonetheless, most countries in Africa are still well above replacement fertility. And in various large Asian countries, the Philippines, for example, where the average family size is still 3 or more, Bangladesh, India, fairly large countries, still well above replacement. It's below replacement in China, by the way, but it's not close to 1 child per woman, which you would think would be happening as a result of their 1 child policy. I argue that it's the wrong policy, it's the wrong way to go about it, and they would have even lower fertility if they just made sure that they had good services available for every couple that wanted it. But so far, I haven't been able to convince the Chinese government of that, although they're making strides in that direction, and the whole policy seems to be less coercive than it was a few years ago. But just to be clear on that, nowhere in the book do I suggest that China's policy is a model for any country. That's more the traditional population control model, top-down, where the government tells women how many children to have. And in my view, that's never really been successful anywhere in the world. It's the opposite that is successful, which is basically freeing women to have the children they want to have in good health, and then they tend to have 2 or fewer. And in China, given that Chinese minorities often, in other countries, often have just 1 child on average or 1.5, I think China would be well advised to follow that example.
Is the U.S. at replacement level at present?
It is, just about exactly, which is interesting because in theory that would mean that we would have a sustainable population or a stable population in at least a few decades. But we also have very high levels of immigration, and that tilts things a bit. We have a lot of young people. That provides a kind of momentum to make sure that even if people are having 2 children on average, that you have so many young people that their children outnumber the older people who are leaving the population through dying. But it's also interesting that in the United States, we have a very, very high rate of unintended pregnancy. And unintended pregnancy is something that I spend a lot of time looking at and exploring in the book, because that really is a situation where you're contributing to population growth, not because parents even wanted to have this particular child, but because there were unintended pregnancies. In the United States, the rate is almost half, which is higher than it is in a lot of developing countries. And that suggests to me that regardless of what we do relative to immigration, which is a major contributor to U.S. population growth, but obviously is quite sensitive and controversial, needs to be discussed more than it is. But I don't have a particular strong recommendation in the book of policies that should deal with it. I think it may not be sustainable at its current levels, but I don't propose a particular policy on it. But in terms of pregnancy and birth, it's easy to propose a policy that would make sure that we reduce the proportion of unintended pregnancy in the United States, and then fertility would be less than two, would help balance out the high rates of immigration that we have, and would bring the country's population size to stability, probably within a few decades. As it is now, there's really no end in sight to U.S. population growth. And as the high-consuming country that we are, that really matters for sustainability. With 5% of the world's population, we're using about 25% of its energy and resources on average. So we ought to be very conscious and indeed talking about the future of our population growth. Europe and Japan don't have much population growth. They'll soon not have any in all probability, but we still have an awful lot. So it isn't enough for us just to have replacement fertility. We probably should have less than replacement fertility or amend to some degree our immigration policy or perhaps some combination of both so that we don't continue to grow this rapidly.
What would be some of the outcomes for society with population declines?
Well, there would be older people on average, but that to me is a small price to pay. I don't even know for sure it's a price to pay at all for longer lives and more intentional pregnancy and childbirth, which is what it's the result of. I think economically there would be a lot of good benefits. We might worry about Social Security, but we have a large housing stock in this country, and there would be fewer people inheriting legacies, and they'd get larger legacies apiece. And by the same token, there would be a smaller proportion of people competing for jobs, so wages would go up. There'd be a smaller proportion of people in societies competing for housing, so the price of housing would probably fall. So there'd be a lot of good economic impacts from a population that was actually declining and aging. And there's no question that from any environmental sustainability standpoint that you look at the issue, obviously there'd be fewer people consuming, fewer people needing housing, fewer people needing energy. So my sense is that what's wrong with this picture? There's more food. There's more land to grow food on. There's less stress on the environment. There's less stress on the atmosphere, more water availability on a per capita basis. All the things that are concerning us now from an environmental perspective would be more abundant per person as population gradually declined. And there's really no danger that I could see that we would actually depopulate ourselves to extinction. Some institutions might change. Some countries might have much lower populations. But I can't imagine a situation where women would just stop giving birth or give birth for generation after generation to fewer than two children. As the world opened up and became less crowded, as housing became more affordable and as wages rose, I suspect it's quite likely that a number of women would say, gee, this is a good time to have a larger family. And you would have this kind of, I call it a demostatic impact of when conditions are right, and this is the way it's worked in history, women have more children. When conditions are not right, when they don't favor having a healthy family, women tend to have fewer. Women themselves are the best people to make this judgment because they're very in tune to the health of their family, the health of the environment around their family. And you would have a sustainable population that probably over centuries would sometimes be growing, sometimes be declining, but probably at a lower level than we see today, and hopefully with fairly abundant nature, which is kind of the picture that I paint in the final chapter of my book.
Well, we're out of time, but what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Support women being able to make decisions about childbearing for themselves and support their education, support higher status for women in every society. There's no society anywhere where women really have fully equal status to men. Anything that you work on in those areas, even if you have no interest in population size or could care less what happens to the environment, all of those are going to benefit demographic change and they're going to benefit environmental sustainability.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
We have just been speaking with Robert Engelman, Vice President for Programs at World Watch Institute and author of the book, More, Population, Nature, and What Women Want. For more information, check on the web at www.morethebook.org. Again, that's morethebook.org. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.